J poles or the H, the full HF antenna over one wire.
Now, when it comes to the patent itself, the 7-digit number you gave me for the patent, I had no trouble finding that. Then you talked about the 5-digit number design patent. I couldn't find a way of making that come up on my patent search. So the 5-digit number, the second number you gave me, I couldn't find a way of making that show.
Repeater, timeout.
If I could get that 5-digit design patent to show up, what would I be seeing on that? Is that the latest update, so to speak? It's not an application patent. I don't know what the word design patent means. Those are your words. How about you, Hal?
So the design patent is the way the studs are mounted on the one section. That's the design patent. But the patent is just being applied for now is the method of being able to switch having the HF loading coil all the way base for 10 through 80 meters and then UHF and VHF on the pole.
Now, the one thing that's not quite clear to me, Hal, and that is, assume now you're building a 3-frequency version of your original 7-digit patent. Let's assume that the top section is 450, the middle section is 220, and the bottom section is 2 meters. Let's just assume that. And now, when you're feeding the upper 450 section, you would like the 3/4 wavelength at 450 to be hot, and you would like none of the 450 energy to spread further down that mast. Do you have reason to believe that the 450 energy is going to stop at that 450 stub and essentially none of it goes any lower? Because if any of it goes any lower, you don't have a 3/4 inch, a 3/4 wavelength radiator. You have a many more wavelength radiator, which could give you an interrupted vertical pattern. Over to you, Hal. KGRIW.
So, Dick, it stops at the base of the quarter wave stub. The quarter wave stub is the base. So basically, you got the quarter wave stub driving the half wave element.
If the quarter wave stub was exactly a quarter wavelength long, and if.
Repeater, timeout.
If the quarter wave stub was exactly a quarter wavelength long, and it wasn't being loaded by anything else to change its wavelength, I agree. It would act like a short circuit and no signal would spread down. However, your wrapping of the cable that's feeding that quarter wavelength stub is now tuning it to a slightly different frequency. Electronically, it's not a quarter wavelength anymore. Therefore, the bottom of that could be a little bit hot. Back to you, Hal, KGRIW.
No, I ran some tests, and at the base, that's UHF, there's negligible radiation. The radiation is on the stub and then on the halfway section. It was driving the halfway section with the stub. And the same thing on the VHF. I'm not counting the 220. But your quarter-wave stub, being that everything is isolated, is driving the whole section. And it's taking into account the UHF part of the antenna. But that's on the VHF part of the band. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you're on a VHF frequency, the presence of a quarter wave stub and whatever is a kind of top hat capacitor, which in theory makes that radiator a little bit different in length, a minor detail. One slightly crazy wording in the patent is that of the desirable characteristics that were mentioned, it was mentioned that the way of feeding the antenna would give it a high angle of radiation. Most vertical antennas, you want a low angle of radiation. So I think the writer of that particular section may have gotten it backwards. Over to you, Hal.
It's possible. Howard Khrushchev was the one who did the patent. And he's a member of Limark, as a matter of fact. All the way back at that time, he's a member of Limark.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And number in inches that you divide by frequency in megahertz in order to come up with length, that number is a little bit on the low side. In other words, it's not using 95% loading, it's using 93% loading, so to speak. And the number that's most recently quoted in the ARRL manuals is 468, which you can convert into inches. So a minor error on that one, but it's a, you know, just a little bit of shift in frequency. Was that number that you use in the patent derived by you? You seem to be quoting it from ARRL's handbook at the time, but I don't think the handbook said that. Back to you, Hal. K2RIW.
He may have pulled that number out of the handbook. It wasn't derived by me. See, basically, I figure the top section coming down 18 inches, and then you're going out 1 inch and coming up 6. It's approximately a UHF J-pole. And coming down, let's say 19 or 20 at 60 inches, and then going up 19 or 20 is approximately a VHF J-pole. And when you slide the coax back and forth, you can attain a one-to-one driving SWR. It's amazing how well it matches.
Yeah, that part I believe. That kind of variable twist and sliding action, where you can almost independently adjust the resistive component and the reactive component, it's going to give you a very good match. Now, in the patent on diagram number 5, you show a 5-frequency version. I think I've heard you talk about also making it work down at HF frequencies. Does that mean you're going to make it longer and just stack more and more of these?
Repeater, timeout.
The thing is, on HF frequencies, I have a loading coil that's being manufactured, and the whip is just being used as the whip, because we isolate those feed cables that are just floating right on the vertical part of that antenna. Then that whole antenna with all of the J-poles acts as a complete whip for the low-frequency coil, which gives us our 10 through 80.
Okay, so by some magic, you're going to float the cables, and you're going to put a loading coil maybe at the bottom in order to make it work at HF frequencies. And at HF frequencies, is it also a J-pole, or is it just a bottom-fed loading coil type radiator? How are you getting it on an HF frequency?
Well, for loading inductance, it's just a loaded, the base-loaded HF antenna. You're feeding it from the bottom. You're using counterparties in a car or a little 30-foot wire, and it works phenomenally. I'll have to show you. It's on the car, my car.
So the patents I can read about, I can't read about the HF version yet. Is that true?
I've got a partial copy that he submitted, and we're going to do the final. I got the art.
You originally had that patent in roughly 1980, I think it was. Was that item ever manufactured, Hal?
No, that was the whole thing, and I figured I might as well manufacture it. And it's all stainless steel. It's shippable. It comes apart. And I've got a machine shop making it, and we've got right now about 35, 40 pieces in inventory.
You got that original patent way back in the late 70s or 80s. What was your motivation for the...
Repeater, timeout.
Stand by. What was your motivation for the patent if you weren't going to go into manufacture of it at that time, Hal? Go ahead.
Well, Dick, I'm going to go into manufacture of it. I just didn't have the funds to do it, because I also had the position transducer I came out with at that time, and the I had 5 patents within 1 year.
When I do a patent search on your name, I find 4 patents. The J-pole antenna, as I call it, the shaft encoder, which has that variable with opaque device on it, and I forget what the other 3rd and 4th patent. I could find 4 patents under your name, Hal. Go ahead.
The 5th was a design patent.
Yeah, but when you look up the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, I couldn't find a way of putting in a 5-digit number. Their ordinary patents want a 7-digit number, or they want a patent application number. I couldn't find a way of getting a 5-digit number to give me a feedback. You call that a design patent. I'm not familiar with that term, Hal. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the one that shows the pictures of the J-pole, you know, the elements on that J-pole, that's a design patent. That was one I gave you with the best digits. And I could give you the copy of the patent. Yeah, there's no problem. I have copies of all that.
And when it comes to that shaft encoder, have you built working models of that, and has that ever become a product?
I built the model. I proved it worked. It wasn't necessary to go to the patent office of model. The only thing a patent office wants a working model of is basic.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, when you time out, I can't hear you. I can't hear you on the input. So therefore, I didn't hear that last transmission. I know that the patent office does not require a working model. I got that much. But you said something after that that got timed out. Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I built a working prototype with a vertical slit and the right triangle. It proved that. And also I did it capacitively. If you saw the capacitive patent where you're wiping basically a capacitive change that's linear. Did you see that one?
Yes, I did. Now, this is a quasi-analog shaft encoder. Does that mean if there's any slop in the shaft, you get a little bit of a wiggle of the apparent azimuth, even if you're not changing the azimuth? Go ahead.
Well, the thing is completely linear, Dick. And also, I came up with one now that is a shaft encoder that converts into tone between 1,000 and 1,360 for the direction system I developed. And that one, I wrote it all, and I can't afford to patent it yet. I just sent all the documentation that I've self-registered.
The original patent on the J-pole, back in the day when you did that, I'm hoping that attorney of yours was a good close friend and a Limark member. Other than that, I presume that patenting process, self-funded by you, could have been a little bit expensive. Is that true?
Dick, that's the interesting part of the whole story. Howard Kashoff on the first patent, the physician transducer, and all the other patents, worked on the premise that we'd be able to sell it into industry. I have given Howard zero for all of the work, but I think for the artwork and everything, but all the fun Howard put in.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Most lawyers take their clients. Howard kids me and says, I'm the client that took the lawyer.
Interesting. In the case of the shaft encoder, analog shaft encoder, where the analog to digital converter is going to give you digits, and the digits then give you a display output. If for some reason the process of the shaft encoder's opaquing object, a triangular-shaped object, that gives you a slight nonlinearity. With modern-day digital circuitry, you can either use a shaping network on the analog. That's not the best way to do it. You can also use a kind of a lookup table on the digital number. In other words, the analog to digital converter then goes to a digital lookup table, which gives you a correction. So therefore, if you ended up with an error because of nonlinearity of, say, your optical detector, let me drop. You could always use an intermediate digital lookup table. Therefore, in theory, you can make the shaft encoding accuracy as perfect as you like, depending on how elaborate you make that lookup table. I wonder if you've considered that option now, KQRIW.
Yeah, no, I gave some thought to that. But I figured the resolution that I'm looking for at the time. See, I came up with that because a ham friend of mine said he wanted a method for reading his beam positions. I was sitting in a diner one morning and I was just doodling and I came up with a way of doing it.
Now, when it comes to the stacked J-pole, you did in your patent quote the three or four pieces of prior art that has a slight
repeater, timeout.
That had a slight degree of similarity. Out of curiosity, where did the idea of stacking J-poles and feeding them in that manner come from, Hal? Go ahead.
Out of my retarded mind, Dick.
Yeah. Diagram number 10 shows a printed circuit version. In the printed circuit version, your foil down on the printed circuit material becomes the J-pole antenna. What's not quite clear is how you wrap the feed cable around the quarter wave stub when that quarter wave stub is a piece of foil down on a printed circuit board. I'm guessing you cut some slots on each side in order to feed the cable through the board around that quarter wave stub. Is that roughly how it's done? Because the patent doesn't make that clear.
Yeah, that's how it's done, exactly. You have some holes, and it's like sewing a string around, and that's how you're attaining the inductive coupling.
Out of curiosity, have you ever built a printed circuit version of that just to see how well it works?
I did. And it's a little hard because I had to be able to I made a couple with hole spacing. But when I got the right hole spacing, the thing took off perfectly.
Okay, there was a whole lot of dropouts there because of overmodulation. I think you're saying you did build a working model, probably on UHF or 1296, for the printed circuit version. Is that a Roger?
No, Dick, I built one on 2 meters. I got the material, printed circuit material, and I made it up on 2 meters.
Yeah, the nice thing about a printed circuit version is that you could start off with a sheet of fiberglass, and with copper tape, you could make the poor man's equivalent of printed circuit material.
Repeater, timeout.
Hello? That would give you the ability to make the radiator very wide, and that would give you quite a bit of bandwidth if you did it that way. Go ahead.
Put the copper down, then I wrap the, use Teflon coax, thin Teflon coax to make the experimental version.
Okay, you and I doubled on a whole lot of that. Whenever I get a dropout, I can hear the dropout, I then drop my carry and wait for it to come back. You then are already talking through the repeater. You don't give me a chance to reset the repeater when it drops out. So when it drops out, when it's talking, I know about it because I'm running full duplex. And as soon as it comes back to life, I continue the conversation. Back to you, Hal. KGRIW.
Deep isn't on yet. That's the whole thing. No, I used copper tape when I made the VHF version. And I just wanted to prove it out, and it worked out very well. See, the beauty of that thing is you could just get such a perfect match once you slide everything up and down.
Oh, I accept the perfect match. And because of that method of feeding, which is quasi-inductive, quasi-capacitive, you have reason to believe that that kind of a J-pole with that method of feeding gives you greater bandwidth. And if so, is it a 2-to-1 greater bandwidth than an ordinary J-pole fed in the conventional manner? What would you have?
Well, for the tests I made, the bandwidth is pretty good for the ratio of SWR. And the situation, I plotted it, and I was very impressed with it. Also, hold on a second.
My original question was, if I took an ordinary J-pole with a conventional method of feeding it, and I plot its VISLOC bandwidth, then I use your technique...
Repeater, timeout.
Then I use your technique for feeding the J-pole, and then plot that. Is your technique of feeding the J-pole giving you a different bandwidth than the more conventional method of feeding a J-pole? Have you ever had those two diagrams on the same sheet of paper? Go ahead.
Not really, Dick. The conventional method, the whole thing is you have metallic contact. With this thing, you have no metallic contact, which is beautiful. You have no dissimilar metals and no check corrosion.
Yes, I accept that. And by the way, the patent also said that because there is no physical contact, all the arcing capability of a human being touching it goes away. There's a little bit of an exaggeration there, but I accept that. So you like the technique of leaving the shield of the coax thoroughly floating. What do you believe would be the disadvantage if the shield of the coax was grounded right where the shield ends, if you know what I mean? What would the disadvantage be of grounding the shield? And for lightning protection, there might be a slight advantage of doing that. Over to you, Hal.
Well, lightning protection, being it's one piece and you have it on a mast, you're going to have a return to ground. The thing is, if the shield is physically connected and it breaks loose over time, you're going to change the characteristic of the feed point impedance, and you're not going to have the tether working most efficiently. You'll have a standing wave.
Your item number 20, which binds the coax to the mast. The way you've got that laid out looks like it's such a strong structure that if it was grounded at that area, I wouldn't worry about the shield breaking away. Over to you, Hal.
Well, see, also, because what I'm doing, I'm able to put control right up that cable, and there's no short with the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Most religious to pull in a relay with INF and Pete and Scorio, it doesn't even see 50 ohms.
You could still be grounding the shield to the coax, putting DC voltage up the center conductor. With the right kind of an RF choke, you would now have commanding to any other external electronics, even though the shield is grounded. Over to you, Hal. You got to talk a little bit softer because you're jumping out of the machine.
Okay, well, the thing was, I wanted to be made where it could be assembled in the field with just panduits, adjusted, and go down the road. We don't have to worry about physical contact with the shield. There's no gain in having the shield connected to the antenna as compared to having it done this way. You're going to have to see the antenna. I have it on my car, the whole Sky Eagle.
Is there a free frequency version on your car? Is that what you're saying?
No, mainly just the two frequency. Well, for having a separate UHF. Because the VHF, we worked UHF, but the place where it nulled out was not close enough to the amateur frequencies. So then when I thought I'll put the other stub on, I got right on the money.
So I think you're saying the one that Barry is using is on 450 and 2 meters. And when I hear Barry, and he's giving out a beautiful signal, I can hear him very well. I'm not hearing you on the input, but I can hear Barry. Is it your antenna that he's using that I'm hearing from his car?
Not at this time. I only put it on sometimes. And not on today. And it is raining out here. Are you guys getting the pouring rain that I'm getting?
Let's take it up south.
Okay, you guys doubled and Barry won out, so I didn't hear a word of what you said, Hal. And you might want to repeat your message, Hal. Go ahead.
Barry, fill him in on what tests you run with your antenna.
Now, he said he uses it sometimes, but he's not using it right now. Back to you, Barry.
Okay. Yeah, I'm actually... you guys kept me company through my whole trip, which was be about 40 minutes by the time I get there. So I'm 5 minutes away from my destination. Thank you very much, and I will join you on the flip trip in 2MB Mobile.
Barry, are you saying of the 82 lights, you've gone through 75 of them?
I couldn't make that out. It's really noisy in the car right now. Just gotta try it again, I'm sorry.
Of the 82 traffic lights you go through, are you saying you have already gone through 75 of them, T2LAW?
I've actually gone through 80. I've only got two more to go.
Well done. And so now, since you didn't have to do any transmitting, you could concentrate on making sure you don't go through any of those lights when they're turning yellow.
Yeah. It's really brutal, I'm telling you. It's brutal. What do I got? One, two... I got three more lights to go. I'm looking at them up ahead of me. And this will be over. Then I gotta do it all over again. I gotta go home.
Yeah, I've got some light rain at my house. Are you saying you're getting some pretty heavy rain where you are?
Very heavy rain. Streets are flooding.
Yeah, I was out there a half hour ago making sure that all of the rain, all the channels where the rain is supposed to go instead of going on my property, I had to make sure that none of them are clogged and everything is working right. My property has got so much clay under it that if any water dumps onto my property turns into a lake, and that lake eventually dumps into my basement. You think you've got water problems, Barry. 300 feet above sea level, I've got water problems. I'm back to you, Barry.
Believe me, I wish I had your problems. Mine are ridiculous. Anyway, I got to make a right turn right here. I'm down to one more light, and I'm there. I'll see you guys in a couple of seconds in 2MB Mobile.
Roger. Barry, you said your car is very noisy. you drive a quiet automobile, so is the noise a traffic light, electromagnetic noise? Is that what you're saying that you're getting?
Oh, no, 1 second. Hold on. Got to stretch this a little. No, it's the windshield wipers and the defroster. You know, it's just making a lot of noise.
And you're talking about acoustic noise, not radio noise. Is that true?
Absolutely. I don't get any radio noise at all. This car is really quiet.
Your car is what kind of a vehicle? What year and what model of it? Go ahead.
The car is about 10 years old. It's a Chevrolet Tracker. It's not a Geo Tracker. They have all versions of it. This is called a Tracker.
Sounds like a nice, reliable automobile. And, of course, it's watertight.
Most of the time.
When it's not watertight, what does that mean? If it's most, if some of the time it's not watertight, what does that mean?
I mean, I get a leak. My right window sometimes leaks a little bit past each side. But it's not happening today, so I'm good.
Maybe that's when the wind blows from that side, Barry.
No, I really don't know what it is. It's just a design. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure why that happens, but it's a rare thing. But every now and then, the passenger sits on a slightly wet seat. And I never figured out. I think it's coming through the window, but I'm not sure. It might be the door seal.
Are you using a mag mount? And if so, how do you bring the cable into the car?
That's not a problem at all. I'm bringing the cable in. It's a mag mount, yes. I'm bringing it in through the back hatch. And I do pretty much what you said. I go sideways, and then I loop it around and bring it through the hatch. That's never leaked, ever.
Yeah, in my case, I've got a four-door sedan, Toyota, and I bring the wire all the way around the perimeter of the door, and I don't cross the rubber...
Repeater, time out.
And I don't cross the rubber seal until the cable is down at the floor level. And so now, any water that wants to get in... around the rubber seal where the cable is going through, the RG-58. There the water wants to pour out instead of pour in. I used to bring the cable in near the top of the door, and you always get a little bit of leak around that rubber seal when you do it that way. You've probably been through that problem already, haven't you, Barry?
It has a lot to do with the design of the back window. There are a lot of ways to do this. One method of having a back window is to have it hinged from the top. Sometimes they're hinged from one of the two sides, sometimes they're hinged from the bottom. Mine is hinged from the top, and it squeezes that rubber seal on that cable really good.
Yeah, that's nice. You're talking about a hatch. I'm using a four-door sedan, and driver's side rear door is what I'm using to bring the cable in. And as long as I do it correctly, it works very well. Over to you.
I'm bringing it through the hatch. It's a little different. And I like it. I'll see you guys later. I got to run inside. And you know what's going to happen? As soon as I come out, get back in the car, all the moisture on my body is now going to fog up the windows. I didn't even have to use the defroster the whole trip. Now I'm going to have to use the defroster the whole way back. See you guys later in 2MB.
And you probably noticed if you ever turn on the defroster, it's got some condensed water on its evaporator core. And from then on, you have no choice but to continue using the defroster. Otherwise, you fog up a car. In your case, your wet clothing is going to fog up the car, and I understand.
Exactly. Okay, guys, I'll see you a little later in 2MB. Everybody go.
We're waiting for... We're waiting for Andy to break in. Andy sometimes listens to us at this hour. WA2CDL.
This is a ridiculous hour for anybody to be up. See you guys later in 2MB.
This is the hour where the real discussions take place, Barry. This is where the juicy stuff gets discussed.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. at 830 WQVL. Repeater system.
This is Kilowatt 6, Delta from Sulu, Ocean 5, Long Island, where the water meets the ground. You can just ground. Also, anybody out there? Anybody around? The conservative repeater. This is Kilowatt 6, Delta, Papa, Zulu, where your opinions can be challenged. K6DPC, clear. QRZ.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
Zombies Mobile. Anybody out there?
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system.
KMB, WBGCSA. WBGCSA.
Mobile listening, anybody out there?
Hello, Hal. M2EO, how are you?
I'm good, Rich. Going back toward the house, Rich, Oceanside. This is not raining, I hope it stopped.
Okay, very good, Hal. Yeah, nothing new here, just thinking about something. And, The phone is still out, so what can I say?
Well, you better get hold of Amy or get rid of her, Amy. That's all I'm going to say. Let's leave it at that.
Yes, exactly. Womane, the home care attendant, just texted her on his phone a few minutes ago.
Leave it at that. I told you I got a letter from Limark.
All right, I guess we'll talk more about that on the phone.
Or a different repeater. I just don't want, you know, a clogless repeater with the stuff that's, you know, frivolous, should I say?
All right, no problem. Like I say, I don't want to ruffle any feathers. So, I'll leave it at that.
Richie, that's where me and you differ. I like to ruffle feathers and, you know, let the bird fall where it may fall.
All right, Al. I like to mind my own business and be friends with everybody if I can. You're never friends with everybody. There's always somebody who doesn't like you. It's natural, but I'm trying to be friends with as many people as I can and not make enemies.
Well, okay, sir, deep easy. Richie, I feel the same way. You know, when you run for politics and everything, you gotta convince everybody you're a good guy. No, I agree. You know, I'm always busy convincing, but certain, you know, powers to be, I'm very jealous, and that's where problems come in. Let me let you go. I gotta check on some stuff here at Stables. I'll catch you later. I heard Barry on this morning, by the way. Me, Barry, and Dick were on the radio at about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that's early. I didn't get up till 9, so I obviously missed you guys. See you later, Al. Give me a call later. Being that I got to talk to Patty about something. So I'm going to go K6DPZ and Tulio.
Okay, Richie. Just pulling into a spot here.
Al, see you later.
N2ZUC KB2BPD.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Calling.
tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
KVH Mobile. Thank you.
Bravo 2, Quebec, Quebec, Romeo. This is Delta, Delta 6, Romeo, Oscar calling. Whiskey Bravo 2, Quebec, Quebec, Romeo. This is Delta, Delta 6, Romeo, Oscar calling.
Station and he's busy. So I gotta bring it back. Alright. Well, I guess it's good that it's quiet. I'm just heading over to the store now. I'm gonna kill two birds with one stone and take care of some errands while I'm waiting.
Alright, Andy. What are you gonna do, by devil dogs?
No, paint. I'm going to the paint store, A-Bus. I gotta buy paint, ceiling paint.
Oh, okay. I know you've been doing a lot of work in the house. Good for you.
I gotta get the paint now. then I gotta get a floor. Pick out a floor for the room. And, just a few more little odds and ends, and then we're done. Well, I gotta get the paint to the ceiling and then the walls. So, Okay, I gotta make a left over here. So I'm gonna go to A-Bus before they close. I don't even know what time they close. They should be open till 9, but maybe they close at 6. I don't know.
I don't know the store, but I'm sure they're open now. Yeah, I heard you were doing spackling the other day.
Was it me? You have a contractor. Yeah, spackling is... The taping spackling is just about done. So now I'm going to buy the paint. And then he'll paint it. So... Yeah, then that'll be done. Be nice to complete this job.
All right, you know, in Whitestone... When I was in better shape, I built my own basement. You know, I finished it. It had been finished by a contractor years before, but it didn't do a good job. It just nailed paneling up, and no insulation, no nothing. So later on, I ripped the paneling down and put it out for the garbage. And my father helped me. He was in his 80s. And the two of us got the sheet box down the stairs up on the wall. And I put it in with a screw gun attachment on an electric drill. And everything worked out. I did my own taping and plastering. It came out very nice.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Sometimes you can do a better job than some of these contractors. So, but it's not hard to do. It's just that it takes time. It's tedious. And you have to schlep sheetrock up and down and everything else. You know, it's a job. But once it's done, it looks nice. That's good. It's good you finished the place. Makes the house more valuable.
That's right, Andy. Well, I use green board. Green board is, it's not waterproof. It's water-resistant sheetrock. Green board. And you know, I had a good deal. White stone lumber, I got it for $4 a sheet, which is unheard of because there was an excess amount of it on the market. Oh, I got some cake down here. Oh, Barry. The dog came down. Anyway, you know, I butted up the sheetrock one against the other. I taped it. I plastered, you know, used joint compound. It worked out great. And under the sheetrock I had was called homosote. Homosote is, it's styrofoam. It's a styrofoam insulation board. And under that, by the concrete, I had plastic. And over the plastic, I had insulation.
Yeah, I think they used green board when they did my bathroom. Had my bathroom redone. Because, like you say, it's water resistant. And they put the tiles over that. And there's green board, I think, in the basement. I think that's where they were using it. Yeah, that's good. Anyway, I just got here. I'm in front of the store. And they are open, so I'm going to go in and get my paint. And take care of this. Because I got a busy schedule tonight. Talk to you later. WHCDL.
Okay, Andy. Catch you later. I'm waiting for the social worker to come. She'll be here in about 15 minutes. So I'm glad we had a contact. WHCDL in Tulio.
Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
KD2, KNH Mobile.
Parkway, going towards the Oceanside. What's happening?
Oh, okay, Al. The telephones are back on. I'll call you in a little while if that's okay. The social worker went to do shopping for me at the supermarket. When she leaves, if you want, I'll give you a call.
Right, when you can, give me a call. There's no problem. My phone's just coming up. Let the battery run down a little bit. So when it runs down, the batteries don't last that long. It's easier to keep it just plugged in the car. Let's see if it's coming in. I got 2% in the battery already. I know, they got to come up with a better battery. That's for sure. But the phone should be able to come up very shortly. Technology, with all the technology, it's still limited with certain things. This one has a few more percentages that you think start firing up. So, give me about a couple of minutes, and the battery should be hot enough where I'll be able to plug in the unit.
Well, I told you, I'm not going to be able to call you at least for another 15 or 20 minutes. Can't do two things at once. But yes, technology on devices is very good, excellent. But battery technology is not kept up.
Yes, I know, Richie. Designs of batteries and everything has been very limited. That I'm very well aware of. Well, look at some better ideas, you know. It's just a matter of basically time. You know, that's why I think having communications being sidebanded as compared to FM even is better as far as the duty cycle.
That's absolutely true. Can't do it on a cell phone. You know, they're limited because cell phones are very small. But they'll get there. Do you remember the days when the Motorola HT20, the batteries were only in the Omni, they were 450 milliamps. They were big. They were NICADs.
HT220s very well. I even remember the HT100s. And the HT220s, as a matter of fact, Richie, a long time ago, I took an HT220 and I put it up on 220.
Yes, I remember you telling me. Well, the big one, the Omni, was 150 milliamp hour battery. The small one was only 225 milliamps. So we made a lot of progress in battery technology. A lot of progress.
Did you ever see an HT100?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Basically a little HT220 chassis, but it was a very small radio, and it only ran like 100 milliwatts.
100 milliwatts? Who used them, the police?
They used it through a car repeater. It worked out really well. Very small radio, a little square radio, half the size of an HT220.
Okay. When was it out? Same time as the 220?
I think it was, Rich. But I'll tell you, I had the fun putting the 220s on 220. And it was so stupidly simple. You just take all the iron core slugs out, you know, the little brass screws with brass slugs, and the puppy ran
right up to the 220 megahertz. Seems crystal, and off we went.
Up.